morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. Members of the court, this is a petition for further review involving a situation in which Mr. Assad's original attorney, who was a new attorney on appeal, attempted to file a direct appeal. That direct appeal was dismissed on the state's motion because the appellate attorney had failed to allege ineffective assistance.
Was it dismissed or summarily affirmed?
Summarily affirmed. Summarily dismissed. The appeal was dismissed in nine words, and saying, citing to the rule and citing to State versus Padura. The issue here is a determination of whether you should follow, or whether the district court was required to follow State versus Dieterman in regards to the procedure to follow when you're alleging ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. Dieterman says that when you've alleged multiple claims, for example, ineffective assistance of appellate counsel and ineffective assistance of a trial counsel and whatever issues you have, they are to only consider the appellate issue. The reason for that being, I think, judicial economy, so that the best relief you can get would be a new direct appeal. It's our position that Mr. Assad is entitled to a new direct appeal.
When was the first point at which he requested a new direct appeal, the procedural context?
In the post-conviction action.
His motion or
later? In the motion
later?
For post-conviction. And then when it came up, it was argued at the trial, since Dieterman applies, but we had no evidentiary hearing. He received no evidentiary hearing. Had he received an evidentiary hearing, the court would have ruled on it, you would have a different fact pattern. But in this particular situation, this was all dismissed on the pleadings. And the state filed a motion to dismiss before the district court, which was essentially what was granted. So that's the procedural posture now. When it got to the Court of Appeals, it becomes clear that Dieterman applies, and as does State versus Collins, the companion case that was cited a few months later, not a companion case, similar case decided a few months later.
What's the purpose of the direct appeal? What's going to be?
It cleans up the record.
What's going to be gained by Mr. Assad?
Well, this court correctly identified it. What's gained is judicial economy. What happens is you have such a confusing, layered set of claims. If you try and allege the merits of the ineffective assistance of counsel claims and the underlying claims of how he was ineffective. And that's what this court said, and I agree with you totally, in State versus Dieterman, followed by State versus Collins, where the Attorney General's office essentially argued the position I'm arguing right here. And for the purpose of judicial economy, put it back on track, give him a new direct appeal, and then if his allegations of the ineffective assistance of trial counsel that he is required to make on a correctly filed direct appeal are not meritorious, it's decided within the context of a direct appeal.
Doesn't your reliance on Dieterman require this to be a case in which prejudice is presumed?
I'm glad you brought that up. And there are two there are two categories of cases. Regarding the presumption of prejudice and Strickland versus Washington, which is what the state's arguing. Presumption of prejudice standard applies when the inmate, the defendant, doesn't get a direct appeal. And you have the easy cases where the lawyer is told, hey, file me a direct appeal, and the lawyer says, I didn't want to do it, there's some meritorious issues. He screws up the filing fee, he screws up the date, whatever. Those things, and it never gets docketed. There are another very small category of cases in which the appellate lawyer actually gets it on file, but then creates something that prevents any consideration for the merits. And that's the Eighth Circuit case that we cite at length out of Hendricks.
What happened in that case?
It's identical to this case. What happened is a lawyer filed an appeal and he wrote a brief in which he really didn't argue the merits. And he loses, and then he tries to clean up the record by filing a recall of a mandate, let's try and fix this, and he loses.
But in this case on direct appeal, it's not really accurate, is it, to say that the lawyer didn't argue the merits. I mean, there was a brief that was filed. Your contention is, you know, and I understand that she raised issues that weren't preserved, but a brief was filed, an attempt was made to argue, and it, so isn't it your contention that she just raised issues she shouldn't have? Or
no.
failed to raise issues she
no.
should have?
No, I mean, and that's the context in which the Attorney General wants to argue. What happened, you know, I was one of the first lawyers that had a case in which the requirement that appellate lawyer raise the ineffective assistance of trial counsel and got procedurally defaulted, and that's 30 years ago, 35 years ago. Every lawyer today knows that is, it should know, that it is a requirement that if you are new counsel on appeal, you must raise every incident of ineffective assistance to trial counsel in the direct appeal, even though you don't have it in the record. That's the rule. Anybody that doesn't know that shouldn't be practicing criminal law. The second rule that you need to know is that it is an absolute requirement that if you make a motion to suppress, that objection needs to be renewed at the time of trial. Those two things are fundamental. Everybody needs to know that, and everybody should know that. This appellate lawyer apparently didn't get all the way through the record. Filed a brief on an issue that wasn't properly before the court. The only way she would get it would have been through her allegations. And what the state did is rather than coming in and say, wave again, say, well, we're going to address the merits, the state moved for a summary dismissal. And that's the order that was entered. And that was the order that was entered, citing to the rule.
Assume it was a summary affirmance.
Well, maybe I'm reading wrong.
Does that change the argument at all? Does that matter?
The result is the same.
But doesn't a summary affirmance suggest that the court considered the issues that were raised and chose to affirm?
Well, that's what the Eighth Circuit dismissed in Hendrickson's case and said, no, you can't make that leap of faith. You can't make the leap of faith that the court below did anything other than saying, hey, look, it was never raised before the trial. We're wasting our time.
So you think it's a... The court misspoke?
No,
it was it was determining the action, but it didn't say the right thing as between dismissed or summarily affirmed or
it was
all
nine
the
words.
Choices?
It was nine words. How do you read those nine words in devolving into having evolved a detailed examination of the appeal is beyond me. Now, if a lawyer comes in...
So you're saying we know it wasn't successful, whether or not the order was accurate. The words,
the
nine words that were chosen, whether or not they're accurate, one thing we do know was it wasn't successful.
What we know is the record below was that the state filed a motion to dismiss, or a summary affirmance, and I apologize, I don't remember exactly what the term was. The attorney then immediately filed something to file a revised brief to fix everything. That motion was denied, and 10 days later the order was entered by the Court of Appeals. And I just think it's a stretch. This doesn't cover the case where the attorney comes in and files an appeal and say has three issues. And one of them is considered on the merits, and the other three, the court says they're procedurally defaulted. And then the client comes in and says, well, my lawyer should have raised five or six. The appellate lawyer under those circumstances gets to come in and say, hey, look, here's what I did. I looked at the whole case, and I made the choice of the three best arguments I had. Was I aware of number four and five? Yeah. Did I think they were meritorious? No. Did I think it was good appellate accuracy to focus on three? Yes. I've been in that situation many, many, many times.
You'd concede Strickland applies in that situation.
Strickland applies in the situation in which somehow you get into the meat of the case. But they never got into the meat of the case in this one. It was dead on arrival.
Did the district court get into the meat of the case on
no.
the post-conviction?
No. Well, there was never an evidentiary hearing. They can't get into the motion. They can't get into the meat of the case without an evidentiary hearing. And there was never any testimony as to why.
Reviewed the record.
Pardon me?
They reviewed the record.
Yeah.
For the trial.
Right. And the presumption is supposed to be that the allegations in the petition, in a verified petition, are presumed to be true unless refuted by the record. And in terms of the actions of appellate counsel, there was nothing to refute what was alleged in the petition. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Mr. Lewis, good morning again.
Good morning again. Just to clarify, I filed a motion for summary affirmance on direct appeal, and that's what was granted. It was not a summary dismissal. With that said, the state maintains that the standard Strickland analysis applies to Assad's claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, not a presumption of prejudice. As set forth in our supplemental brief, the U.S. Supreme Court has explained that there is a presumption of reliability when judicial proceedings have taken place. So to overcome that presumption of reliability and apply a presumption of prejudice on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, the failure must be complete to the point that we lose that presumption of reliability. In the context of appeals, the only situation in which the U.S. Supreme Court or this Court have applied that presumption of prejudice on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim is where an attorney has neglected or failed to perfect an appeal despite being requested to do so. This carries a presumption of prejudice because, in that context, the defendant has been entirely denied that judicial proceeding, so there can be no presumption of reliability to a proceeding that didn't take place.
Is it your position that that's the only circumstance in which prejudice would be presumed for an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim? Anything beyond just failing to file the notice of appeal?
The state's position is that, essentially, yes. If a direct appeal has been filed and appellate review has taken place, we submit that the standard is Strickland once appellate review has occurred. Say you had a situation where perhaps you get the notice of appeal docketed, you don't file briefs, and it gets dismissed accordingly without any sort of appellate review or disposition. It's kicked, so it's dismissed. Not affirmed, not modified, anything dismissed because of that, arguably. I would agree that that's perhaps chronic.
But what if you don't, that's kind of conventional chronic speak. What about in, for example, in Sundquist, if there's, the appeal gets docketed, but there's no assignments of error? Which the court then would not take up the merits, but for possibly plain error.
Well, in Sundquist, it ended up getting to the merits of the arguments advanced there anyway, because despite not assigning errors, the attorney did in fact argue them and the court got to the merits.
Yeah.
So it did get there. it wasn't limited to
And therefore the one appeal of right was addressed.
It was addressed.
As luck would have it.
Right.
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 In absence of assignments of error.
Yeah, we could go into Sundquist here if we're going to go down that route. My response is threefold to Sundquist. Number one, with all due respect, it's a concurrence, and it's at least as of yet not majority opinion. Number two, to the extent Sundquist would suggest that when a direct appeal has occurred, that we may presume prejudice when a direct appeal has occurred and appellate review has occurred, we would respectfully disagree with that notion. I think once appellate review has occurred, we're in the realm of Strickland, not a presumption of prejudice under Cronic or Flores-Ortega. And the third
we're,
point...
But now
make,
we're exploring, there's an appeal filed, but there may be some failure, I'll just say, use as a general term, right? Some failure that could result in a presumed prejudice. If that's kind of where we're at?
That's where the appellant wants to be at.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We're disagreeing. With that premise. Well, where we're at, in our view, is the fact that a direct appeal occurred, appellate review occurred, and now we're reviewing, under Strickland, we should be reviewing, layered claims under a Strickland analysis, not
Thank
a
you.
Presumption of prejudice.
I think your brief accurately points out that the Sundquist concurrence said it's only a short distance from the failure to... file a statement of errors to complete deprivation, but it's still a distance.
It is still a distance, and one other significant point I would make with respect to Sundquist or the context of it is that was a direct appeal. whereas this is a post-conviction proceeding. And as Weaver v. Massachusetts makes clear, there is a significant distinction between addressing an ineffective assistance of counsel claim in a direct appeal versus a post-conviction proceeding or another collateral proceeding, a drastic difference, and that's where we're at here. But nonetheless, with respect to the standard in general, the state's position is still that even if, as long as a direct appeal occurred and appellate review did in fact occur, we should be applying Strickland.
What's your argument as to the Eighth Circuit case that appellant cites in his supplemental brief? Is that incorrectly decided? Is it distinguishable? I think it's the Hendricks case.
Yeah. I don't know that it's... I guess you could argue it's distinguishable.
I had a hard time discerning exactly what the failure of appellate counsel was in that case.
I did a bit as well. As I understand it, appellate counsel filed a brief and just sort of made comments but didn't really provide authority and legal reasoning that would justify disposition in their favor. So they basically said, this is nothing, and accordingly, it's the functional equivalent of nothing. As you were pointing out in discussion with opposing counsel, I mean, arguably that's distinct since here, appellate counsel did, in fact, provide a brief. She extensively assigned and argued those errors. It was a 40 or 40-some page brief on the matter. Very thorough. She just mistakenly, she missed the fact that it wasn't preserved. So I think it arguably would be distinguishable. But, yeah, I mean, ultimately, I guess our position is that we disagree with the rationale of Hendricks. It's certainly not binding on this court. And I would certainly disagree with that decision in the sense that it's that's a decision in the context of federal habeas relief. And in order to obtain federal habeas relief, you have to have something that is in violation of clearly established federal laws established by the United States Supreme Court. I'm aware of no decision where the U.S. Supreme Court has taken some situation other than neglecting to get an appeal filed and said, well, this is close, and we're going to call it the functional equivalent and presume prejudice. They haven't done that. So, frankly, I don't quite understand, with all due respect to the Eighth Circuit, I don't understand that he said that is in violation of clearly established federal law. It isn't, in my view. So I respectfully disagree with that decision.
Maybe if we were to look a little bit at the merits, appellate counsel failed to take up the failure to renew the suppression motion. Maybe that is deficient, but not prejudicial. Maybe it wasn't a good motion.
Well, that sure. I mean, had she assigned it properly, that
would
have been our response.
So all we could say then is it's deficient. I mean,
right.
Most lawyers should know to do that, as Mr. Susie has indicated.
Sure, we can all.
Which
agree
is the
that.
Distinction between deficient and ineffective.
Absolutely, that's just one of the two prongs. You have to show prejudice as well, and our position is that when we apply Strickland, we have to look at both prongs, and there would be no prejudice here. They haven't pursued their layered claims, so I'm not sure that this court even needs to entertain a Strickland analysis, since they've abandoned their layered claims and went solely with the argument that they want and should get a new direct appeal. But
this is outside the appellate area, but in terms of presumed prejudice, there's a few of them out there besides the appellate area. Like if your client says, I want a jury trial, and you don't ask for a jury trial, that kind of thing.
Sure. Oh, yeah, yeah.
That,
expect a trial procedure.
Right, trial procedure, but we're focused on appellate.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
If we were to head down the path your opponent asks us to go, we would be enveloped in a whole bunch of hair splitting about when did this apply and when didn't it under the existing U.S. Supreme Court precedent. The line is pretty clear.
We believe that it is, and that's what we're advocating, to keep the line clear, because that's a workable rule that we can apply across the board. And again, our position is that if the appeal occurred and appellate review occurred, then we should be under Strickland, not a presumption of prejudice under Cronic or Flores or Ortega. But
Thank you.
I agree with that sentiment, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, we would ask you to affirm the judgment of the district. Thank you. Court of Appeals.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments for the day. The court is adjourned and you are excused.